Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm Eric, and I'm with Michael Ross today. Michael is a professor of history at the University of Maryland at College Park, where he specializes in the United States constitutional and legal history. He is the author of two prize-winning books, Justice of Shattered Dreams, Samuel Freeman Miller and the Supreme Court During the Civil War Era, and The Great New Orleans Kidnapping Case, Race, Law, and Justice in the Reconstruction Era. Michael serves as the associate editor of the Journal of Supreme Court History. He served as the historical advisor to the United States Mint and has twice delivered Silverman Lectures at the United States Supreme Court. He holds a JD from Duke University School of Law and earned a PhD in history at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Professor Ross, welcome.
Hello, Eric.
So how are you doing today?
Eric, I'm fine. How are you? It's getting to the hectic part of the semester here, but otherwise all is good.
Michael, when we talked about coming on the show, I was kind of curious about what you wanted to talk about. And you said, you know, you're interested in how the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Harvard admissions case, Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard. You use the term cynically, uses the language of the 14th Amendment to declare universities' affirmative actions programs as unconstitutional in a way that actually runs counter to the interpretation of the amendment. Do I have that right?
We're in the midst of admission season, as any parent of a applicant to college knows. And for faculty members, it's also admission season for the graduate program. So we had to take all kinds of trainings this fall on how to adjust our admissions policies to that Supreme Court decision. So this is the Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and the accompanying case against the University of North Carolina. It's a decision in which the court tries to argue, and Clarence Thomas in particular, reflects an originalist interpretation of the 14th Amendment. And as a constitutional historian, although sometimes some constitutional historians don't want to admit it, we kind of like originalism in that it makes history important. You know, that you're interpreting an amendment, and there's lots of historical research that has to go into your argument because you're trying to argue what the original purpose of the amendment was.
When you say originalist, what does that mean for folks who aren't familiar with constitutional law?
So when it comes to interpreting the U.S. Constitution and what the language of the Constitution means, one mode of interpreting the Constitution is one known as originalism. And originalism is the idea that you interpret the language of the Constitution based on what people thought that language meant at the time the Constitution was written, or in the case of amendments, at the time those amendments were written. So it's not original intent, which is the idea that you try to get into the head of the people who actually wrote it. Originalism, what did people who not only wrote it, but then passed it in Congress and then ratified it and read about it in the newspapers, what did people think it meant at the time?
Okay, so now go back to what your main point is and what your frustration is. I shouldn't say frustration, it's putting words in your mouth, but what your concern is.
So my concern is that the court, and Clarence Thomas in particular, tries to argue that their decision in the Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, which came to the conclusion that using race as one of a number of criteria in deciding who to admit to your college, violated not only the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, and in particular, the phrase in the Constitution that no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. Thomas and other justices are arguing here that their decision in that case reflects what the people who wrote the 14th and ratified the 14th Amendment intended, which was that all things involving the government should be race neutral, and that admitting people to college in as one of the criteria being their race discriminates against other people of different races. And what they're getting wrong is that they're they're taking the 14th Amendment while claiming they're giving us an original interpretation of the 14th Amendment. They're taking the 14th Amendment and the language of some of the people who wrote it almost completely out of the historical context of the moment.
Just for clarification, I believe the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868.
Correct.
And I think that's important, right? Because we're not talking about something that is very modern. So it almost sounds like what you're saying is when you evaluate the 14th Amendment and saying you're looking at its original intent, you'd have to say, well, this was the way the world was in 1868.
First of all, I'm not doing about original intent. And second of all, there are different modes of constitutional interpretation. Some people say the language at the time is a marker, but you have a living constitution that was designed. The language generally was broad enough that the constitution could adjust to changes in society. Originalists often are conservative justices who are trying to keep the constitution from being interpreted in ways that expand the power of government over time beyond what its original framers intended. And, you know, many liberal justices are living constitutionalists. Many conservative justices are originalists. And what I am arguing is that I am taking the originalist interpretation of the 14th Amendment that Clarence Thomas and others use in the Students for Fair Admissions case on its own terms, but arguing they get the history wrong, which is a criticism of originalism generally, which is that Supreme Court justices and their clerks aren't great historians. And what they'll do is go back into the past and cherry pick evidence from the past to support their point, but it often isn't good history. It's cherry picked evidence done in a kind of a lawyerly like fashion to make an argument, but it doesn't reflect the historical record accurately.
So what are two or three examples in this particular case? And if you want to talk a little bit about the UNC case and use examples for that as well, but what are some examples of that cherry picking?
Well, again, the UNC case and the Harvard case were combined.
Yeah, in this decision. Yeah.
They're deciding them both at the same time. The cherry picking would be this. The justices, and again, in particular, Clarence Thomas, who takes a whole point of his concurring opinion to say, I want to make an originalist defense of this argument, are saying that the folks who wrote the 14th Amendment intended to make a colorblind world where eventually race wouldn't matter. And as a result, when we're talking about what equal protection means, no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. When we're talking about that, it applies to white people and black people equally. And white people and other minority groups equally, and that an admissions decision that favors particular groups by giving them a leg up in the admissions process isn't treating white people, in this case, they would argue also Asian students,
right,
equally with black people, that it's violent, that it is an equal protection violation because it is not colorblind. And what they are missing, but they're not missing it. They know it. You know, Clarence Thomas knows this, is the context of the passage of the 14th Amendment. And anyone who spent time in the records of the 1860s, in the newspapers, in the congressional records, knows why the 14th Amendment was passed. And I'd like to talk about that now. So Civil War ends, 1865. And the freedom of African Americans will be enshrined the following fall with the 13th Amendment. Nevertheless, after Lincoln is assassinated, Andrew Johnson, a president who was not particularly progressive in his racial views, allowed in the American South ex-Confederates to hold elections the following summer, in which they elected back to the state legislatures many of the leaders of the old Confederacy. And those state legislatures, at a moment known as presidential reconstruction, Johnson's going to tell them, look, slavery's over. You're going to have to ratify the 13th Amendment and be good with that.
So real quick, Mike, talk a little bit about what the 13th Amendment is. Not everyone.
The 13th Amendment ends slavery. That says there can't be involuntary servitude in the United States except for punishment of a crime. And those legislatures, in an effort to ensure that African-Americans would continue to work on the plantations and to deliberately create a racial caste system, began passing a series of laws known as the Black Codes. And the Black Codes said things like African-Americans can't meet in groups of six after sundown, can't buy alcohol, can't own a firearm, that African-Americans at the beginning of each year have to be able to produce a paper showing where they're going to be working for the coming year. And if they could not, they'd be fined for vagrancy and sentenced by a court to pay off the fine to work on a plantation for the coming year. And it was a whole series of laws about when African-Americans could give testimony in court and all of these other things designed to both separate the races and force African-Americans to remain put on plantations and work for their former so-called masters. And the 14th Amendment reflected Northern revulsion at what was going on. You know, Andrew Johnson's mailbox is filled up with letters saying, you know, my son's dead and now slavery is restored in the South. How could you let this happen? And restored in fact, if not in name. And in response to that revulsion, Congress called together a committee that did all kinds of investigating on what was the condition in the South, the Joint Committee on Reconstruction. And out of that committee came the language of the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment was designed to make sure that Black codes couldn't happen. And I'll read you the 14th Amendment, Section 1, which is the operative section here. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the states where they reside. That piece undid the infamous Dred Scott decision before the war, in which the court had ruled that African Americans can never be citizens of the United States. Now, with the 14th Amendment, it says, if you're born here, you're a citizen. Then it says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And all of those are aimed squarely at the Black coats, that we're not going to have a society that is going to treat Black people different. If you want to have a law that says people can't meet in groups of six after sundown, have at it, but it can't apply just to one race. And it's that historical moment that is the framing of the Equal Protection Clause.
So let me get this right. It sounds like you're saying that Justice Thomas's argument is weak because it says that everyone's equal and therefore there should be no race-based bias, despite the fact that the very amendment was targeting race. And so his originalist argument is weak.
It misses the moment. It misses the moment, which was we need to pass an amendment to protect African Americans from biased legislatures. This is at the same moment that, you know, the Freedmen's Bureau is helping African Americans build schools and do things in order so that African Americans can get a fair shake in this new society coming out of slavery and into freedom. The moral bank of light that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which gave African American men the right to vote, that comes off of those, is that these were amendments designed to assist African Americans throw off the burdens of slavery and enter an equal place in American life.
So your argument seems to be that the logic was flawed in terms of using the 14th Amendment. Someone can make the case, though, or could they, that this is America. It's a meritocracy, and we shouldn't be using race as a factor in admissions to college anyway. Because going back to your point, what is college's role in life, liberty, and property?
Yeah. So, well, you're on a different clause. You're on the due process clause.
Well, people have to be wondering. Clause. My point is, people are probably wondering about
you're
that.
Entering into a different sphere of this than the constitutional arguments, which is what are the criteria that colleges, both state, private and state, should use or can use when admitting people? And there's a whole bevy of criteria, but even under the Supreme Court's 40 years of precedent allowing some level of affirmative action in college admissions, they recognized the value in Grutter, in Bakke, and all these other decisions in having a diverse student body, that the discussion in the classroom changes when there are people of different races in the room. And that's absolutely true. You can feel it. And not all African-Americans think alike, but if you have African-American students in the room, it often, particularly in discussion, causes other students to think about what they're saying, to think about different perspectives. And the Supreme Court had long, over decades, has recognized that colleges, in order to create a diverse class, have the ability to have that as one criterion. And both Harvard and UNC is by no means the only criteria.
Right. Well, let me get back to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, so one of the things that struck me, and I do want your take, because I think this is worthy of discussion, which is, you know, the suit was originally filed by Asian families. How did we get from this argument about how Asian families felt that they were discriminated against because they had higher performance-based scores, and they accused Harvard of using intangibles in terms of what you might experience at a job interview, you know, likability, personality, you know, gets along with others, and they didn't score as high, and that was Harvard's argument. How did we get to this idea that that's race-based? And Harvard doesn't. I mean, you could argue it seems like that Harvard has the right to decide how it's going to admit people on likability or on get plays well with others.
Or plays sports well.
Correct. Right. Exactly.
Any level of other criteria that are used to admit people and give a student a notch up on the chart. Well, part of the question is, first of all, before you say it, originally brought by Asian families who are then going to be funded in this by conservative groups. There's a couple $1 million of funding is paid for by conservative foundations, but there's about 4 different conservative foundations that funded this litigation who don't like affirmative action. And I think when you get down to it, so for example, the state of North Carolina, I think, is about 20% African-American. And I think UNC might have 10% of the student body is African American.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And part of the admissions decision is if we have a whole bunch of equally qualified candidates who are, you know, we may or may not let in, one of the things we want to do is have the classroom reflect the state. And we're going to, in this pool, which isn't solely basing the criteria on their test scores and their GPA, are African-American students that we're going to give what as one of the things, one of our criteria, African-American students that we might add to the admissions list in order to create a diverse and representative classroom.
Right. And well, the thing that strikes me is in the business world, more and more companies are seeking out diversity because they recognize what you were saying, which is you get a more diverse employment or population who works for you, the better ideas you're going to get, the more thoughts, and that's going to make your entire organization better. So,
well, and you have the fact that universities have other purposes, that we're creating the next generation of leaders, that, you know, there's a whole series of reasons. And, the military schools use affirmative action because they want African-American officers in a military that has lots of African-American students. And, you know, the litigants in this case, after lots of discovery, couldn't find a single case of someone who was admitted solely because of their race. Everyone that was admitted had lots of both scores and intangibles that qualified them for admission. But the question is, if you're allowing race to be a criteria, does that violate the Equal Protection Clause? Because if you removed race as a criteria, there would be perhaps some people who get in because race wasn't used as a criteria.
What is the larger implication of interpreting the 14th Amendment this way and having this potentially change how colleges admit students? What's the implication broader than just college, the overall society?
Well, I think you're arguing that any use of affirmative action by the state or any institution that receives federal funds, and that could be a broad sweep, will be perceived as unconstitutional. But before we get too far afield, Eric, I want to go back to my original point as to they are misreading the 14th Amendment historically. And I want to go to a decision of the Supreme Court back from the historical moment. The first case in which the Supreme Court interpreted the 14th Amendment, where that broad language, they were asked to interpret what it means, comes in 1873 out of New Orleans, and it's called the Slaughterhouse Cases. And it's an interesting decision because the first people who try to use the language of the 14th Amendment in a case that reaches the Supreme Court are not African Americans. They're butchers from New Orleans, all white, who were fighting a regulation passed by the state legislature, which was now both black and white legislators, that required them to not do their butchering in the city of New Orleans, but instead do it across the river in a state-created slaughterhouse, because they had been dumping all of their refuse into the Mississippi in ways that went straight into New Orleans drinking water. And as the butcher said, you know what? Let's take these amendments, which we don't like. These were not people sympathetic to the freedmen. The 13th Amendment, we're going to argue that this is slavery to make us do this. We're going to argue that this denies us the equal protection of the laws. This denies us the due process of the laws and due process of law. And they get as their counsel a former Supreme Court justice who was Jefferson Davis's Assistant Secretary of War in the Confederacy, John Archibald Campbell, who says, this is clever. Let's take this language. We know why these amendments were passed, but now we're going to use them to fight Reconstruction legislature. And the white conservative press in New Orleans, the ex-Confederate press, is going to say, you know what? You're using these amendments like you would use one poison as an antidote to another. And they cheer them on. And this case reaches the United States Supreme Court, who's now suddenly out of the gate being asked to use the 14th Amendment for a very different reason than why we all know it was passed. And in that opinion, in which they reject the butcher's claims, this is what the Supreme Court says, Eric, and I'd just like to read it. And he says, we repeat then, in the light of, this is Justice Samuel Miller, who I wrote about, we repeat then, in the light of this recapitulation of events, almost too recent to be called history, but which are familiar to us all, and on the most casual examination of the language of these amendments, 13, 14, 15, no one can fail to be impressed with the one pervading purpose found in them all, lying at the foundation of each, and without which none of them would have even been suggested. We mean the freedom of the slave race, the security and firm establishment of that freedom, and the protection of the newly made freeman and citizen from the oppressions of those who had formerly exercised unlimited dominion over him. It is true that only the 15th Amendment in terms mentions the Negro by speaking of his color and his slavery, but it's just as true that each of the other articles was addressed to the grievances of that race and denied to remedy them as the 15th. And they go on to say, we're going to be hard-pressed to expand these amendments beyond African-Americans, although if someone tried to enslave other people, we might go there. Now, we know over time, the amendments are used for a whole host of things. And by the end of the 19th century, the 14th Amendment is largely and almost exclusively, when it comes to some of these questions, being used by corporations who are declared persons under the 14th Amendment to fight state regulations during the, you know, the late Gilded Age and into the 20th century. By 1930, the Supreme Court, of all the cases they'd heard involving the 14th Amendment, only 1% are about African Americans, and it becomes about corporate rights. But over time, thanks to the mesmerizing legal campaign of Charles Hamilton Houston and Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments will be restored in part to their original purpose, you know, leading to Brown versus Board of Education and all the cases that follow. What's happened here is a return to the slaughterhouse era. And somewhere, people who funded that litigation are drinking martinis and smiling. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, plus the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VI, were used by the Supreme Court to strike down a admissions program that partially is attempting to undo the effects not just of the history of slavery, but of Jim Crow and income inequality and all the things that we know exist in American society, the inequality still based on race. So my... the fact that the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 were just used to strike that down, that's why I think it's cynical. They know what they're doing. The reason why the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is passed is so that African Americans could get a fair shake, that Jim Crow would come to an end, that at least in the places that federal legislation could reach, African Americans would be able to go to the same licensed businesses and be treated equally, could be hired in places that accepted federal funds equally. So, and Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, I'll read it to you. No person in the United States shall, on the ground of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. But it's that very clause, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that the Supreme Court uses to overturn North Carolina, the University of North Carolina's admission policy that includes as one criteria, not the sole criteria, as one of, you know, five or six criteria for admission to the university in order to create a more diverse class.
If I'm summarizing, this is me. This is not, I'm not saying this is what you think, but what I think I'm hearing is that these arguments that are aimed at overturning admissions policy, admissions rules of universities, public and private, allowing a more diverse population is centered around race. Those arguments are disingenuous and they're being led by conservatives. And there's just a clear link in what you're talking about between conservatism and racism. And that's what it seems like. That's just that's how the dots line up to me.
Yeah, I think that's too strong. I am saying firmly here that there is not a dot line up between conservatism and racism. I think there is one branch of conservatism that believes the government should stay out of people's private lives, that recoils against government programs like affirmative action as an unfair meddling with the private decision making of people. And I'm not, but I there are plenty of conservatives who are not racist.
It was partly a leading question, knowing that. So my question then, because that's how we can build, if there is just a strain that might be, that means most maybe are not. So how do we go forward as a society then to acknowledge that the 13th through the 15th Amendments were created for a very specific reason. The 1964 Civil Rights Act was passed for a very specific reason. How do we go forward and say we should still be advocating for those things, despite the fact that people do seem to use them as a justification to give, you know, BIPOC communities less access to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
A complicated question, Eric. I can say that I am at the center interested in how the Constitution is interpreted. And if you are going to be at a self-espoused originalist, you should get your history right. And you should be an originalist that understands the context, not just picking quotes from the time that suit your argument. If you're going to be a living constitutionalist, living constitutionalist says the language of the Constitution adjusts to modern needs. And in this case, the Supreme Court really are being living constitutionalists, where they believe that affirmative action might have had its place in time, but that's now over. And we're now going to interpret this language in the Constitution in a way that ends what they see as programs that are no longer needed. And this is going to be the same for the Shelby County decision on the Civil Rights Act and other things. But that in many cases, then we can't go back in other areas of our interpreting our Constitution to originalism. You can't be originalist when you want to be and not when you don't want to be. So that's really where my axe to grind is here.
How do you explain that to your students or to folks you're talking to over the holidays? Because you know this always comes up.
I hope I explain. I don't know who wants to stop Thanksgiving dinner for a long discussion of originalism and the interpretations of the 14th Amendment. But I think if you just go slowly, Americans can understand their Constitution and how it's interpreted by various people, but it's not rocket science. And lawyers like to throw around a lot of terms and subclauses and this, that, and the other thing and case names, but most of it's pretty clear. And I think that throughout, you know, the Constitution's complicated. There's a bunch of stuff in the original Constitution, all the clauses on slavery and other things that show it's a complicated document, but it's also full of lots of ringing language, both in its original body and in the amendments that are very positive in American life. And I am really just suggesting that if we're going to use an originalist interpretation, that moment after the Civil War, where a group of people in Congress and outside decided that they wanted to make a fairer society and passed amendments to do so, that's what those amendments should be used for. And decisions that undo efforts to do that are misusing amendments that were added to the Constitution to create, as Lincoln called it, a new birth of freedom.
What I really enjoyed about this conversation is that you have pointed out that if you pay attention and just for a little bit, you can understand the Constitution and its intent and why, you know, there is. It doesn't necessarily make sense to say I'm an originalist when you don't take into account the intent of those amendments. And so I think you really helped us understand that. We have to go, though. So thank you very much for coming in today. Folks, if you like the show, tell your friends and go to AshevilleFM.org. Click on shows and scroll down to Solutions for the Underaffiliated. Check out all of our podcasts of this show and blog at underaffiliated.com and stream Asheville FM live from our site or the app. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.